Today's show is brought to you by Underbrush, a new thriller by Kevin Carr. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the Emoji Movie, Atomic Blonde, A Ghost Story, and Landline. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, some listener questions, and the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
One more celebrity death I needed to talk about this week, and it happened, you know, it was the trifecta where you had George Romero, then Martin Landau, and now you had John Hurt. Actually, also, June Foray, who did the voice of Nastasha and Rocky in the Rocky and Bullwinkle show, and she was known as the female Mel Blanc sometimes. A lot of people would call her that. She died at 99 this week. So there was another one in there. I mean, I remember in like the 80s when she was still doing those voices, and she came back and did the voices for like the movie they made in 1999 or 2000. I remember she was old then, but yeah, 99. That is one heck of a run. So yes, June Foray. I don't want to forget her, but I also want to talk about John Hurt. And he died this week at age 71. Apparently, he was recovering from surgery, and they found him. He had passed away. But the thing with John Hurt I want to talk a little bit about is he was such a great character actor. He was one of those actors who had leading roles, but nobody was running out there saying, I got to see the latest John Hurt movie. But everybody knew who he was from playing even though Big wasn't a movie with bad guys and good guys, you know, like Star Wars. I mean, Big had John Hurt as essentially the bad guy, as the big kid, the bully as an adult. So he sometimes played real jerk characters, sometimes conniving, mean characters and villains. But he also played just nice guys. He was the average guy. He was the average suburban dad, and that's where a lot of people remember him from, of course, was Home Alone. He had this ability to play average nice guy and really smarmy, unappealing characters. He can kind of bridge that gap, and you don't get that a whole lot. He's been in a ton of movies, everything from Chud to Home Alone, you know, to even more recent stuff. I mean, he was a working actor. And he was one of the most recognizable faces, at least, in the 80s and 90s, and particularly the 90s was, I think, when he really cemented himself as a legendary character actor. So it's sad to see John Hurt go. It's also sad to see June Foray go. The next piece of news I want to talk about is something that hit the internet late this week, and it was a story about how IMAX is signaling it's going to pull back from 3D. And of course, I see all my cinema friends going, isn't that awesome? 3D sucks. And I'm like, I don't necessarily think that people were rejecting 3D as much as they were rejecting the upcharge. When 3D took off about 10 years ago, or less than 10 years ago, it was before Avatar, but Avatar really pushed it in the mainstream. But when 3D took off back then, it was a novelty, sure, and it was a bit of a gimmick, but then they realized that it was going to cost a little bit extra to install in theaters, so they started doing like a 50% upcharge, and that's when people backed off of 3D. My theory has always been people like 3D. If you give them a choice, price the same, do you want 3D or not 3D, I think a lot of people would choose 3D because it's kind of cool and it adds to the cinema experience. If you tell people you can see this movie in 2D, or you can pay 50% more and see it in 3D, they're going to go see it in 2D. And that's when you really saw people back off. And this is a great example of how theaters, they made these changes. And this is what's happening to the cinema experience. They make these changes, either to 3D or selling alcohol or putting in barca loungers into the theaters. If you have to pay more for that, people will not pay more. People want a reasonable experience. Now, right now, there seems to be the new fad is, and a lot of people will get mad at me for saying this is a fad, but I think it's a fad, this sort of large format IMAX presentation. there are some people who that really makes a difference to them. They'll go see the movie in IMAX because it's the thing to do and it's a theatrical experience. But I still think that that upcharge is going to suppress the viewership in a couple of years. You've really only had the real push for IMAX. I mean, IMAX has been around for a while, but you've really only had that push for IMAX maybe 5 years right now. I mean, you're talking about like Dark Knight Rises was when it was really being pushed as large format IMAX. But you might see that wane a bit. I think the other reason why people like IMAX theaters is because the seats are bigger and the seats are farther from people and you have less of a chance of talkers and people being problematic in the theater, even though they are. So I don't think this has anything to do with wanting that cinema experience, is that people don't want to pay $20 to see a movie or $15 to see a movie. They want to pay $10 or $7 or $5 on a bargain matinee. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. We got a trailer for that. It actually dropped right before Comic-Con. I mean, I could just sit there and rattle off a whole bunch of Comic-Con trailers, but to be honest, a lot of the trailers from Comic-Con were for movies I've either already covered, like Thor Ragnarok, or they're movies that are maybe aren't hitting as high of a level of some of the stuff that came before it or right after it. But the first one I want to cover is The Shape of Water. Guillermo del Toro comes out on December 8th.
She deaf?
Mute, sir. She can hear you.
You clean that lab, you get out.
This may very well be the most sensitive asset ever to be housed in this facility.
You may think that thing looks human, stands on two legs, right? But we're created in the Lord's image. You don't think that's what the Lord looks like, do you?
First of all, this stars Sally Hawkins, who's one of my favorite actresses, and you remember me talking about her last week in the movie Maudie. But she plays a mute woman who has a special bond with this, basically this creature that's being kept in this underground government facility, which it looks like this is kind of like a prequel to Hellboy. Because this looks like Abe Sapien. But I love Guillermo del Toro's work. It took him a while to really have me grow into loving him. His earlier stuff I'm sort of meh on, but his recent stuff like Pacific Rim and even Crimson Peak, I really think these are some great pieces of work. He's somebody who can find the beauty and the love within the cracks of horror. And that's, I think, what makes this movie look like it's going to be really interesting. The next one I want to talk about is Ready Player One, which caused a lot of stir at Comic-Con. It comes out on March 30th.
I live here in Columbus, Ohio. In 2045, it's still ranked the fastest growing city on Earth. But it sure doesn't seem like it when you live in the stacks. There's nowhere left to go. Nowhere. Except the Oasis. The only place that feels like I mean anything. A world where the limits of reality are your own imagination.
Now, first of all, I have to note this takes place in Columbus, Ohio. Now, in 2045, so of course their version of Columbus, Ohio looks quite different. The thing is, though, I think we got a lot of things that need to change in the next 28 years for Columbus, Ohio to end up looking like that, because that's not what Columbus, Ohio looks like. But Ready Player One looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. It looks like Spielberg's channeling a bit of his production design for Minority Report, which wasn't my favorite of his films. This is already getting a backlash because Ernest Cline, who wrote this and helped write the screenplay, he's getting under fire from the internet because, you know, he's a, you know, neckbeard jerk kind of thing. I don't know him. He's from Ohio, but I don't know. But a lot of people are lashing out at Steven Spielberg for being somebody who helped make the 80s popular and then doing a nostalgia movie about the 80s. But I think the big backlash for this is the same reason why people don't like The Big Bang Theory. I know there are people who are geeks who feel that The Big Bang Theory appropriated nerd culture and made it mainstream, and it's not real nerd culture. It's sort of like I've complained before about people who like Doctor Who but only like the new Doctor Who. But I don't know. I mean, Ready Player One looks interesting. I mean, I want to know a little bit more about the story. If it's just, you know, Freddy Krueger and Ninja Turtles fighting each other, that's going to be cool for about a half hour. I don't know if you can make a whole movie out of it. But we'll see in March. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about A Ghost Story and Landline. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Keikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Gosh, I had a lot to cover in that first segment. Let's roll into the movie reviews. We got two to cover in this segment, and I think these are interesting movies because they're smaller ones. They're the ones coming out of limited release into full release, and the other one is sort of making its way around the country. The first one I want to cover is A Ghost Story. When a husband of a married couple dies in a car crash, his remaining spirit haunts the home where he had lived.
When I was little and we used to move all the time, I would write these notes and I would fold them up really small and I would hide them.
What'd they say?
They were just like things I wanted to remember so that if I ever wanted to go back, there'd be a piece of me there waiting.
I've been saying on radio interviews and in discussions that A Ghost Story is one of the most literal named movies out there. I mean, you also got the Emoji Movie this week, which is, it's about emojis. So yeah, I mean, it's a very literally, there's not a whole lot of subtext to the title. It is a story about a ghost. And in this, it's got Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara playing the married couple. And Casey Affleck spends most of the movie in a very cliched ghost costume. I mean, it's a bedsheet with like holes cut in its eyes, sort of like, you know, the Charlie Brown ghost, I got a rock kind of thing. That's one of the interesting ways they do to kind of avoid having to do too many special effects, not just for budget, but because I think director David Lowery didn't want to make it an effects movie. It's an emotion movie. The other thing, though, just because it's called A Ghost Story does not mean it's a horror movie. Don't expect the next version of Paranormal Activity or a Conjuring movie. That's not what this is. This is a drama. It just has a ghost as the main character. And in that sense, once the ghost comes in, because once he dies in a car crash and he becomes the ghost, it's told from his perspective, not just from, you know, the camera perspective, but how the ghost might perceive the world. Because as a ghost, you don't have to worry about eating or sleeping or hurting yourself or time even. The time's very fluid in this movie. It jumps ahead sometimes days, weeks, months, years, and shifts around a little bit from a time perspective because he's stuck in this house, looking for closure. And at times it's a very passive movie because it's just the camera through the ghost's eyes or from the ghost's perspective, just watching things happen. And you'll have something that just goes on and on and on. There's a scene with the wife grieving and she's eating like a pie that somebody left. You watch her eat the whole pie. And it takes like 5 minutes of screen time. You know, it's just her, wrestling with the emotions. And whereas a movie always wants to cut, take out all the dead air of life. And then you can put it into a cohesive 90-minute or 2-hour movie. This one lives in that time. But at the same time, it'll jump ahead almost like a dream where it just continues on and suddenly you're 5 years later. And so you see him, especially as she leaves. She eventually moves on and you see other people who move into the house. At a couple points, it becomes very, you know, almost obnoxiously introspective. There's one scene in there where one of the future owners of the house or people who are living there, it's basically a bunch of 20 somethings or whatever the millennials of whatever year this takes place are sitting around the table talking. And this one guy's just spouting garbage philosophy, the kind of garbage philosophy that drunk people talk about late at night in a dorm room or something like that. And that's really annoying because it's so deliberate and so literal for the movie. He's just quite literally explaining the movie. And then when I watch the trailer, they use that to help explain the movie. And I feel, well, that just seems so heavy-handed. But it's an interesting perspective. And the movie's not fulfilling at all, but that's kind of the point of the film. It's about being unfulfilled, because that's kind of what a ghost is. A ghost is an echo of someone, maybe not even a full spirit, but an echo of somebody wanting closure for something on earth that they're never going to get. And that's why they linger, and that's why they languish in their haunting. So it's an interesting way of getting in the ghost's head. And I think it's an interesting movie. It's not exactly a great movie, but it's unlike anything you're going to see. So I'm going to have to say that A Ghost Story kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about Landline. In 1995 New York, a family struggles with issues of fidelity and respect.
What did you do today?
Crack. Has anyone spoken to Dana this week?
Can they pick a date?
Not yet. I was hoping the dress would sort of get her excited.
What is that?
Engagement ring.
You finally did it.
Yeah, it's nice. It's very good.
Mom!
Oh, jeez.
What's going on here?
I was hoping to crash here for a few days.
My sister might be having a nervous breakdown.
I'm flailing. I'm just trying to figure out if the life that I have picked for myself is even the one that I want.
You may never figure that out.
This movie is the sophomore directing effort of Gillian Robespierre, who is best known for directing Obvious Child. And that also starred Jenny Slate. And in a lot of ways, this movie feels exactly like a second feature that isn't nearly as good as the first. It, in a lot of ways, Maid was a spiritual sequel to Swingers. And even though it was directed by a different director, it was Jon Favreau doing his thing. And it just, Maid wasn't nearly as good as Swingers was. There was a lot of punch and interest and cool stuff happening in Swingers, but Maid was kind of awful. And that's kind of the way I feel about Landline. It's like Gillian Robespierre said, and she worked with a writing partner, I think her name's Elizabeth Holm, and wrote the story and said, well, Obvious Child was about a woman played by Jenny Slate, who was about, you know, Jenny Slate looks a lot younger than she really is. She's like 35, but I think she was always playing in her 20s. And in Obvious Child, she played a woman who got pregnant and then had to wrestle with whether or not to have an abortion. And it was her dealing with the personal issue of that with all the outside influence. And one of the things I liked about Obvious Child is, regardless of where you fall in your opinion of abortion, I thought this presented a human look at the people making those decisions. Now, when it comes to Landline, it's like they said, okay, let's take Jenny Slate, put her in another movie about people in New York dealing with some form of adversity, which would normally make you a social pariah, you know, and it's about infidelity and affairs, and it's about these two sisters and their fathers having an affair, and then Jenny Slate plays one. I couldn't quite peg how old she was, because like I said, Jenny Slate's in her mid-30s, but it felt like her character was pushing 30. And she's getting married, but then she has an affair herself. And then her sister is this really abrasive, unappealing, nasty teenage girl. And I grew up with a sister. I know how teenage girls can be. I have sons who are teenagers, and they bring their friends over. I know teenage girls. And they're not all these caustic, horrible monsters that you see in this movie. And I that's one of my biggest problems with this film, is they're not nice people. The entire family is not nice. They're mean to each other. You can barely see any love. The sisters end up kind of having a moment where they get along, but that's because they want something out of each other, not out of the pureness of sisterhood or the pureness of family. See, there's a big difference between I got pregnant and I have to struggle with the question of whether to have an abortion, which was what Obvious Child is about, and I just don't want to settle down. Am I making the right choices? I'm going to go have sex with this guy and then have more sex with this guy and have more sex with this guy. And I'm going to justify it because my dad's having an affair. Somebody wants an excuse for bad behavior, and they're caustic, horrible individuals that I wouldn't want to spend any time with. So I'm going to have to say Landline sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Emoji Movie and Atomic Blonde. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life.
Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy it hurts.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Continuing with the movie reviews, let's talk about the most talked about movie this week, which is, oddly enough, the Emoji Movie. Let's just play the trailer, get this over with. A meh emoji feels too many emotions and is in danger of being deleted by his user's smartphone.
My name is Gene, and I'm supposed to be a meh. You know, like, meh, who cares? But my problem is, I have more than one emotion.
What if you get sent out on the phone making the wrong face?
We are go for meh.
Who, me?
What's he doing?
He's making the wrong face.
I'm an emoji. I've got to have some sort of purpose here.
I'm going to help you. We need to get off the phone and find the source code.
Then I can fit in.
Let's roll.
This movie, first of all, they didn't screen it. That I know of. I think that there may have been people like in New York and LA that got screenings because they tend to get screenings for everything. But they certainly didn't screen it out here in the sticks. They didn't even screen it in Ohio. I don't think it got screened anywhere in the region, let alone the state or the city where I'm from. I managed to go find an early show of it. And they finally, at first I didn't think they were going to even have Thursday night previews, but they did. And when I went there, it was filled with people. And I think part of the reason they did a Thursday night preview is because they might have been trying to get ahead of the bad reviews. Because right now, I think it's at like, going into the weekend, the last time I looked, it was at 0% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is an amazing score. I don't even think X versus Sever has a 0%. I'm sure at some point somebody's going to write a positive review just to be contrarian, but this movie is the most unnecessary animated film I have seen possibly in my life. I remember when they made the Angry Birds movie last year, and I said this is unnecessary, but at least Angry Birds had a story behind the game. And even though they had to do some gymnastics and shoehorning it into a plot for a movie. But how do you make a movie about emojis? And then I went and saw it, and it's just, it's so forced because they want it to be about emojis, but there's no story behind emojis. And what you end up with is this story that is really just a ripoff of Inside Out. And you know what? If you're going to rip off a movie, don't rip off one of the best movies that's ever been made in animation, especially in the last 5 years. Inside Out is such a great movie because Pixar worked, and Pixar didn't say, let's do high concept, but we're going to wrestle with some real things here. We're going to talk about emotion and the complexity of emotion and how a child gets more complex emotions as before. So it's not just happy and sad, and you can have a mixture of both and bittersweet. So it really worked. This weird high concept, completely out of the cloud idea for Inside Out worked. And then the Emoji Movie just kind of steals the idea, but doesn't present it well at all. It's not terribly fun. There's like maybe one or two things that are funny. And ultimately, it's a harmless movie. I mean, and I didn't hate it. It wasn't one of these things where I, you know, it's not like Baywatch that I just, or Transformers 5, which was just excruciating to watch. And I just was squirming in my seat waiting to leave. I was just kind of bored with this movie. And it's got these insanely heavy-handed product placement. You've seen the Candy Crush product placement in the ads. But they've also got like Snapchat and Crackle for some reason is all over this kid's phone. They never mention it, but it's all over the place. And they got like Twitter and Dropbox. Let's have a whole scene in the Dropbox. It is so clear that this is just pushing a 1 minute idea. And like maybe 5, 6, 10 years from now, emojis will be a thing of the past. And this movie won't even make sense. It's not going to live. And the other thing is, if you really do a deep dive into this movie, it is disturbing. I mean, I remember reading a story a couple weeks ago that talked about if you do a deep dive into the idea behind Cars, it gets kind of disturbing because they have Cars characters in the Disney movies that are like World War II soldiers and generals, and they refer to World War II and the Battle of the Bulge, which if that took place, then there would have had to have been a World War II for cars. And if there was a World War II for cars, you can assume there was a car Hitler somewhere and that there was a car Holocaust that went on. You're like, and then you start trying to figure that out. It's like, it gets really disturbing. But that's just because they're playing with the idea on there. But the emojis, it's like, if you start, you don't even have to dive very deep, but if you start thinking past this, you're like, well, wait, so these emojis, because he's got parents, so they must have sex. And you have these deleting things, and they like, I mean, deleting is killing a program, quite literally. But they kind of just blow it off as like, oh, well, they got deleted. It's like, no, if these are really emotional creatures, you're murdering people. And very much like Inside Out, it's got the user on the outside. But even then, it's not realistic to how a phone, I mean, and I'm not looking for realism because I know it's a movie about emojis, but they don't even have like the phone working right. It's sort of like Tron dropped acid. And you could argue that Tron was like Tron dropping acid. But this is really like Tron dropping acid, and it doesn't fit together. It's such a house of cards. And if you think past the moment you're on screen, it just completely collapses. The best part about the movie, actually, is there's a short film at the beginning from, because they do Sony Pictures, which does Hotel Transylvania. So they have a little Hotel Transylvania short film, which is adorable, really. And I like the Hotel Transylvania stuff because I love monsters and reminds me of Drac Pack when I was a kid. That was on the Saturday morning cartoons. So that's the best part of the movie. So go watch that movie and then leave. And that's it. But no, this movie is, the emoji movie is the poop emoji. That's my review of it. It's a poop emoji, but it's just, it's harmless, but it's still the poop emoji.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Atomic Blonde. Charlize Theron plays a lethal MI6 agent who must find a list of double agents in East Berlin in 1989, right before the wall comes down.
Lorraine Broughton, expert in intelligence collection and hand-to-hand combat.
Agent Gascoigne was killed last night. He had an atomic bomb of information. Find out who's hunting our operatives. The clock is ticking, and everyone you get close to ends up dead.
Someone set me up. Someone from the inside. Now, this only ends one way. A bullet.
A lot of people are heralding this as saying, oh, this is like a female James Bond. And, you know, I think that honestly, I think Angelina Jolie might take issue with that because she's done other movies like this. I mean, not just the Tomb Raider movies, but I mean, very directly James Bond kind of movies like Salt or even Mr. and Mrs. Smith. When she did those 10 years ago. So this is not exactly new, but it's great to see Charlize Theron kind of coming to her own as an action hero. And we got a taste of this with Mad Max Fury Road. And I think that this works better as a film because it's about her. You know, a lot of people compare it to John Wick, and because there's some the directors involved with both movies, and it works. The big reason to see it is to see Charlize Theron, not just her kicking butt, but she looks great, and there's nude scenes, so I'm all happy with that. But she looks good in the movie. She completely plays that part very well. So she's that Jane Bond or James Blonde kind of character that really does work. It's not as good as like a James Bond movie, and it does feel like it runs long at times because it's about 2 hours. And yeah, James Bond movies are more than 2 hours, but they go places. Most Bond movies, they go to 4 or 5 different international locations. This all takes place pretty much all in East Germany. And there's only so many hovels and crappy apartments you can go into in East Germany before the sets kind of start to look the same. This is a fun movie, and it has this great action set piece, just like 10 minutes, maybe 15, of like one of those one-take action scenes. And it's really incredibly well done. It's absurd and it's over the top, but it's really well done in terms of action and one takes. And the other thing I like about it is she's not impervious. She's not a superhero. In fact, the movie opens with her. It's a flashback movie. So it opens with her battered and bruised and beaten up and trying to heal, as opposed to like the Fast and Furious movies where like literally a parking garage falls on Dwayne Johnson and like the next scene he's in a cast and then he busts out of it and goes, I mean, those are like Wile E. Coyote cartoons. This one, it still is absurd, but it at least remotely tries to exist in the real world. And it gets kind of predictable at times. I knew where twists and turns were going. But yeah, you know, I mean, watch Charlize Theron kicking butt. It's a fun R-rated action movie, and it's enjoyable to watch. So I'm going to have to say Atomic Blonde kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be answering some listener questions and talk about the weekly box office and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring James Gunn's Slither.
Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish things up with a couple questions from a listener. This comes from our good friend, Red State Gabe. He actually sent me two questions. I said, let's work them into the show because I think these are interesting questions. First question, he says, how come some low budgets or even some known franchises like Friday the 13th have the same name of the movie as a production company? And he sent me a picture of a movie called Tony, which is a horror movie. And the production company was Tony Pictures. And he says, I can't imagine Tony Pictures will go on to do more films, or do they normally? Well, it's all about corporate policies. When you make a movie, it's a business venture. And in order to make a movie, you usually set up a production company that's just for that movie. A lot of times, especially for independents or smaller ones, they'll do like an LLC. And you do that so the investors and the producers and the directors are protected by the corporate veil. And that way, if like this movie Tony you're talking about, if it gets sued, if they find somebody complains that they stole their idea or somebody got hurt on the movie and they're going to sue the production company, they can't sue the actual people who put money in and worked on it. It protects people. That's how the corporations work, especially if it's an independent movie. And a lot of times if it's generated by a major studio, that is less important. But if you're talking about independent films or smaller movies that are acquired in any sort of way, they always start with small ones. Like the example that comes to mind is a Kevin Smith movie. Kevin Smith has a production company called View Askew. Now, it's a small production company. It's basically like him, I think, and, you know, one or two investors, like maybe Scott Mosier or something like that. But when he makes a movie, like if he's going to make Clerks 3, or when he made that awful Yoga Hosers movie, he creates another LLC in which to make that movie. And that protects his corporate assets from View Askew and himself personally. And so every movie, and if you go especially to independent films and you look there, they'll always have a different production company name at the bottom from the distributor or the lead company. Those companies are literally made to make one film and that's it. Because if they made another film and that film got attacked, then they can go after the profits from the first film. So that's, they just keep them all separate. So that's why that happens. Now, the next question he had is, he's been watching horror movies, he said, and so he noticed that Night of the Living Dead starts showing up in a lot of horror movies. And he was on a rant about the fact that every time there's a movie within a movie, every time there's a scene where you go in someone's house and they're watching a movie, it's Night of the Living Dead. And he's like, is there a reason for it? And there is, and it's a super simple reason. The reason Night of the Living Dead shows up as a movie within a lot of horror movies is because it's free. It's in public domain. And that happened because of some little weird loophole in the law that they changed the name on the poster and they covered the copyright notice. And back in 1968, you actually had to file and put the right name and you had to notice it the first public time. And because they didn't do it, it was before the Copyright Act, it went into the public domain at the release. And that's, a lot of people have said that should never have happened, but it is. And so no one ever has to pay any royalties to show Night of the Living Dead. I can take it and put it up on YouTube. It's public domain. Nobody can take that down. And it's in the public domain, so it's free to use. And there's a lot of high quality video prints. And you can go to the Internet Archive and get a full HD version of Night of the Living Dead. These are not hard to find. And it's been put out there. Most horror directors probably have a copy of it on DVD or Blu-ray somewhere. And because it's such a seminal movie. I mean, it's a well-known movie, and it has some great lines. They're coming to get you, Barbara, then breaking in the house. There's quick scenes that you can look at and immediately identify as Night of the Living Dead, so you know what people are watching. That's the big reason they do it. The biggest reason is because it's in the public domain. And other movies you're going to see a lot as movies in movies are films like Carnival of Souls. That's in the horror domain. So you actually see Carnival of Souls a lot. The one ghost with the dark eye makeup coming out of the water. That's a very common scene. You'll see that in a lot of other movies. The other one is House on Haunted Hill. That's in the public domain. So it's not uncommon to see the skeleton coming out of the acid pit at the end and the woman screaming. Those are really probably the three most common horror movies you see as a movie within a movie because nobody has to pay any royalties. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office real quick. I mean, it was not a terrible surprise that Dunkirk won the box office. I said about $40 million. It did better than that. It did $50 million. And a lot of that is because of premium format. I talked about premium format in the first segment. And I do think it's a bit of a fad, but I mean, for like one or two directors like Quentin Tarantino or Christopher Nolan, these are movies that you get the cinemaphiles going to. The big surprise of last week was Girls Trip. Girls Trip made $31 million, which was really good. And I'm sorry I didn't see that movie. And like they did screen it and that did extremely well. I mean, you know, good on Girls Trip. I mean, and that's not unexpected because, you know, like I said last week, it was targeted at African-American females, and the African-American female audience is very strong. They will love going to movies, and especially if there's nothing out there for them to see, which there isn't really an African-American-centric or certainly not one geared towards women right now, that's, you know, something like, you know, either a Tyler Perry movie or The Best Man Holiday or these sort of like Lifetime-type movies like Obsessed or whatever, those kind of movies. They don't have any of those right now. So, of course, Girls Trip was going to do extremely well. And then Valerian did $17 million, which isn't great. But that is not where it's going to be making its money. It's making its money overseas. It just hasn't been released there yet. This week, it's going to be a horse race. I think there's going to be like, it's going to be $5 million difference between the Emoji Movie, Dunkirk, and Atomic Blonde. Dunkirk's going to hold well, and it's got the premium format bump. The Emoji Movie's not going to do great. $25 million's not a great July number, but, you know, it's a kid's movie. And then Atomic Blonde will do well, but I think it's going to be the least of them, mainly because of the R rating. And there's plenty of other grown-up fare out there. But I really do think it's going to be a horse race. But Dunkirk will probably win, but I think Emoji's going to sell more tickets, but there's going to be a lot of kids' tickets in. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on James Gunn's Slither. An alien invasion of mind-controlling slugs descend on a small town in the 2006 tribute to 80s horror movies.
We've got a real problem.
Don't let him in your mouth!
They're doing things to people. Turning them into some kind of monsters.
How's everybody's evening? Good?
Something's wrong with me.
Slither.
Have you ever seen anything like that?
Me neither. And I watch Animal Planet all the time.
I remember when Slither came out back in 2006. And I saw it, I absolutely loved it. And it's funny, because on the Blu-ray itself, the new Blu-ray, they have about a 30-minute interview with James Gunn. And he's talking about it in retrospect of the movie, which is 11 years old. But he's talking about it now that he is a multi-billion dollar director with Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and Guardians of the Galaxy 2. So he can talk about these movies, not as a guy who started in Troma and was doing these small little movies that a lot of people didn't even know existed. He can talk about these as a major motion picture director. And he talks about how they almost didn't screen it for press, but then it did extremely well with the press, and it's one of the best reviewed horror movies of all time, really. And that's because it worked with nostalgia. It had throwbacks to The Thing. It has throwbacks to Night of the Creeps. Actually, some controversy because some people said that it was a bit of a ripoff of Night of the Creeps, or Invasion of the Body Snatchers, or The Puppet Masters, or all these different movies that are about mind control. But Slither is such a fun movie. It's got its trauma roots and its splatterfest roots. It's clear that James Gunn loves horror movies, and he was making a love letter to horror movies. It's got a great cast. Nathan Fillion is quite funny in it. Elizabeth Banks is great in it. And Michael Rooker, it kind of helped make his career again, you know, 20 years after doing Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. Now, the new Blu-ray, I don't know if they've had this on Blu-ray before, but it's got, like I said, it's got new interviews with Gunn and actor Greg Henry. It's got commentary on deleted and extra scenes. And then it's got all the, like, older features that originally came out on the DVD, like, you know, visual effects and set tours and video diaries from both Lloyd Kaufman from Troma and Nathan Fillion and a gag reel. There's a lot of stuff on the DVD that is imported into this new Blu-ray. So Slither's a great movie. If you've never seen it, check it out. It's an R-rated horror movie, but it's a lot of fun. So I'm going to have to say Slither totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
The other DVD and Blu-rays this week, you've got Ghost in the Shell with Scarlett Johansson and The Boss Baby, Unforgettable, and Gifted. And that is it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The Dark Tower and Kidnap. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.